Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
This episode of Swindled may contain graphic descriptions or audio recordings of disturbing events which may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Petrotrin has a long and rich history dating back to the first oil well drilled in our country in the mid-1800s, which firmly places it amongst the oldest existing oil and gas companies in the world. Petrotrin, as the national petroleum company, operates to optimize the return from its resources for the benefit of its shareholders and the citizens of Trinidad and Tobago.
Petrotrin has a 100-year history through its predecessor companies. We will therefore continue that legacy and continue as a responsible state enterprise in a sustainable manner.
Trinidad and Tobago is home to one of the world's oldest oil industries, but for more than half a century, it was controlled almost entirely by foreign interests. The country gained independence from the United Kingdom in 1962, and in the decades that followed, its government strategically and diplomatically wrested control of its natural resources away from corporations like BP, Shell, and Texaco. Trinidad's prolonged effort to modernize and nationalize the country's energy sector culminated in 1993 with the creation of Petrotrin, which consolidated the nation's oil assets under a single state-owned entity. But that progress had come at a cost. Rapid growth outpaced safety standards and infrastructure. Environmental damage was widespread, and accidents were frequent and mostly swept under the rug. However, there was one incident that the country could not forget, a moment that exposed the true cost of neglect and signaled the need for reformation within Trinidad's oil industry. It happened on October 17, 1985. A crew working for Trintalk, one of the state entities later folded into Petrotrin, was nearing the completion of a recommissioning project on a quarter-mile subsea pipeline that ran along the floor of the Gulf of Paria between offshore berths 5 and 6 near Point de Pierre. The final step was a routine task, unbolting the slip line that had temporarily blocked flow in the riser, the vertical section of pipe that extends out of the water and connects to the surface facility. More than a dozen workers arrived at the site on a steam-powered barge just before noon that day. The job proceeded as planned. By 12:30, the 250-pound steel blind had been removed, but then, moments later, a massive fireball erupted, engulfing the vessel and everyone on it. The workers dove into the ocean to escape the heat, struggling to swim in their heavy helmets and boots. It was a hopeless endeavor. Everything within 200 feet of the barge was coated in burning oil, even the surface of the water. The blaze was so intense that fishermen more than 20 miles away reported seeing the flames whipped into a frenzy by strong winds blowing directly back onto the boat. The fire service arrived within 10 minutes and quickly contained the flames, but the scene continued to burn for another 2 hours. When the all-clear was given around 3 p.m., the carnage was assessed. 13 men were pronounced dead, about half from burns or smoke inhalation. The others most likely drowned, trying to escape. The remains of 2 men were discovered in the bathroom of berth number 5. Arms wrapped around one another in a desperate embrace during their final moments of terror. A few others were recovered underwater, still clinging to the pipes for dear life. Miraculously, one man was still breathing when rescuers pulled him out of the oil-thickened water, but he died on the way back to shore. His name was Ramjohn Kerbin. He was 38 years old. And in the days leading up to the tragedy, according to his family, Ramjohn confided that he sensed death on the horizon.
It was an unimaginable disaster that rocked the country. 14 men lost their lives after a major explosion at Trintalk's berth number 5. Barges and other vessels went up in flames, resulting in $4 million in losses.
Early media reports speculated that a passing vessel had struck the pipeline on which the Trintalk crew was working. But that theory was soon disproven. because there were no moving ships in the area. And even if there had been, a collision wouldn't explain the catastrophe that followed, because the pipeline was supposed to have been fully purged of anything flammable. But it wasn't. A government-appointed investigation later determined that the pipe still contained thousands of barrels of liquid hydrocarbons, and when the crew removed the flange, they unknowingly released a cloud of volatile vapor into the surrounding air. All it took was a spark from a backfiring boiler, or maybe a stray strike from a metal tool. Investigators couldn't say for certain. Regardless, the result would have been the same. 14 men, aged 35 to 50, lost their lives in what remains the deadliest industrial accident in Trinidad and Tobago's century-old oil industry. According to investigators, the tragedy stemmed from, quote, the non-observance of standard safety procedures, lack of planning, coordination, and proper supervision within the various departments involved in the removal of slip blanks. The pipeline was not suitably prepared for the operation planned, the investigation concluded. Who exactly should have been held accountable was never made clear. The Trinidadian government never publicly released the full report of the investigation. No one was ever charged or even fined. Instead, certain executives and supervisors were quietly shuffled between departments in the years leading up to the Petrogen merger, while unions and workers continued to repeat their familiar, often ignored demands for basic safety protections. And worst of all, as one local newspaper wrote, the government-run oil companies treated the families of the dead men, quote, like dirt. Widows and children, suddenly without their breadwinners, received no financial assistance, not a dime. They were essentially abandoned, and it wouldn't be the last time.
I don't know what to do. This is going on for years. It's not now. It's going on for years and years and years.
That's Hafiza Kerbin, the daughter of Ramjan Kerbin, the man who temporarily survived the 1985 Trintalk explosion. But the anguish in her voice isn't about the day she lost her father. It's about something else, something that happened 37 years later. In a haunting echo of the past, Hafiza's brother, Faisal Kerbin, a commercial diver, would be sent to the same exact location to work on the same exact pipe, where he would, arguably, suffer an even more horrific fate than their father's. An offshore maintenance job goes catastrophically wrong, and four men are left for dead inside an underwater pipeline on this episode of Swindled.
They bribed government officials,
accounting clear violations of federal and state law,
clearly unethical,
paid to play millions of taxpayer dollars that were wasted,
paid tens of millions of dollars,
$1 million.
By falsifying its books and records,
responsible for the collapse of the entire system.
In the role of some kind of swindler.
It's official, there are now two new companies to replace state-owned Petrotrin, the Heritage Petroleum Company and Paria Fuel Trading Company.
The Paria Fuel Trading Company will be located at Point of Pier and will handle fuel logistics and the energy trading aspect of the business. We are told this company will ensure fuel security for the country by supplying fuels for automotive, marine and aviation applications, in addition to bunkering and selling crude oil to the world.
Chronic financial losses, mounting debt, aging infrastructure, and declining production ultimately pushed the Trinidad and Tobago government to shut down Petrogen after 25 years in operation. In 2018, officials announced the company would be dismantled and its functions split, returning in some ways to a structure reminiscent of the past. The production of oil and gas was transferred to Heritage Petroleum Company, while distribution, importing, and storage were assigned to Paria Fuel Trading Company. That latter company, in 2021, decided to recommission the quarter-mile subsea pipeline connecting berths 5 and 6 near Point of Pier, a line that had sat idle in the years since the refinery had closed. Paria Fuel brought in a series of subcontractors and maintenance crews to bring it back online, and by February 2022, the project was nearing completion. Only one step remained, repairing a damaged section of Berth 6 60-foot-tall riser The work would have to be done underwater, so Peria turned to Land and Marine Construction Services Limited, or LMCS, a firm whose divers were trained exactly for that kind of job. 36-year-old Christopher Boudram was one of those divers, and he was eager to get back to work. A month earlier, he had lost his mother, then he contracted COVID-19. Returning to the water felt like coming home. Ever since he was a child, the sea was where he felt most at ease. On the morning of the job, Friday, February 25th, 2022, Christopher woke at 4 a.m. It was cold and raining. Like usual, he said a prayer, exercised, ate breakfast, and kissed his wife and three children goodbye before heading to the dock at Peria's offices around 5:30. By then, the rest of the LMCS dive crew was arriving one by one. They were his closest brothers. There was Kazim Ali Jr., someone Christopher had known his entire life. They were the same age, raised around the same work. Chris called him Small Kaz, a nod to his father, Kazim Ali Sr., the owner of LMCS. Then there was Rishi Nagasa, whom everyone called Blacks. At 48, he was one of the most seasoned divers on the team. But the most experienced was Faisal Kerbin, known as Faizy. At 57, he was often referred to as the group's father figure. He had been diving since before some of the others were even born, including 31-year-old Yusuf Henry, the youngest member of the crew that day. Like Christopher, Yusuf was returning after time away. Just months earlier, he had lost two brothers, 16 days apart, one to COVID, the other to a blood clot. This job was a welcome distraction. After receiving their work permits from Peria, the five men boarded a barge for the 20-minute trip out to Berth 6. Once on site, they gathered for a toolbox meeting to review the job scope. What they were being asked to do wasn't exactly routine, but it wasn't out of the ordinary either. The damaged section of the riser, which had already been replaced with a temporary blank, sat about 15 feet below the surface. It was 30 inches in diameter. The assignment was to remove the blank and bolt the new permanent section into place. Less than a full day's work, probably, if everything went according to plan. An 8x8 hyperbaric chamber had already been secured around that portion of the riser. The divers called it a habitat, a pressurized enclosure that allowed them to work underwater in a dry, breathable environment, with the air continuously pumped inside. From above, supervisors could monitor the operation via a mounted wall camera. There was also an emergency radio available, just in case something went wrong. Later that morning, the five LMCS divers suited up, pulling on their wetsuits and strapping on their scuba gear. Before entering the water, they paused for a photo. Christopher Boudram, Blacks, Faizy, and Yusuf descended 15 feet and entered the habitat through its hatch. Small Kaz remained topside, keeping an eye on the job from the boat. By 1:45 p.m., they were already halfway done. The temporary blank had been removed, and the four men resurfaced briefly for lunch. 30 minutes later, they dove back down. Their next task was to install the new section of the riser, but first, they had to remove the migration barrier inside the pipe. It consisted of two plugs. The lower plug was inflatable, designed to expand and seal the pipe, preventing dangerous fumes from entering the habitat. Above it sat a rigid metal plug, a safeguard against falling tools that could damage the inflatable seal below. That one had to come out first, and it loosened without much resistance. The inflatable plug, however, was another story. Around 2:43 p.m., Small Kaz, who had just come down to check on the team, volunteered to swim back up to fetch an extra wrench, a moment captured on the GoPro camera mounted to his helmet. When he returned, Rishi Nagasa was already working the valves on the plug. That's when Christopher Boudram noticed it. The water level inside the habitat was rising. That wasn't supposed to happen. "Let's get out of here," he shouted, lunging for the hatch. But it was like his body was frozen in place, suspended in zero gravity. He grabbed the sides of the chamber, trying to steady himself. Then everything started to spin. a sudden, everything went pitch black.
Pitch black, you can't see nothing.
Chris felt like he was being hurled through space at impossible speeds. His eyes burned.
Eyes burning.
His throat burned.
Your throat burning.
His ears ringing.
Ears ringing.
He couldn't breathe. It was like being caught in a tornado, he said. Being violently slammed against metal and battered by debris.
Unbelievable nightmare.
Chris said he realized what had happened when his body hit a bend in the pipe. The elbow, as they call it, where the vertical riser met the horizontal line, stretching across the seafloor, 60 feet below.
And at that point, I told myself I was going to die.
He tried to slow himself, pressing his hands and feet against the walls. It did nothing. The pipe flew past him, hundreds of feet, in seconds. It felt like an eternity. He couldn't hold his breath any longer. See you soon, Mama, he said to himself. Then it stopped. His body came to a rest, and suddenly, he could breathe again. For a moment, Chris didn't know if he was alive or dead. Within seconds, he realized it was a fate far worse. It was as if he had been sealed inside a metal coffin. He lay on his back, his body submerged, only his face above the oily water. The pipe pressed in on him from all sides, barely inches from his shoulders, the ceiling less than half a foot from his face. There was no room to move. Every inch of his body throbbed with pain. Then he heard a voice. Chris. It was small Kaz. I'm inside the pipe, Kaz shouted. Chris answered back. I'm inside the pipe too. There were other voices in the distance. Chris began pulling himself through the darkness toward them, calling out names. Kaz was closest. His leg was broken. Next was Yusuf, who said he had shattered his hand and foot. Behind him was Faizi, mostly unscathed. And deepest in the pipe was Rishi Black's Nagasaw. He was unresponsive, but alive. They could hear him moaning in pain. All five of them were there, trapped in a small pocket of air formed by the contours of the seabed. The air they were breathing had been sucked in with them, and it was in limited supply. Chris suggested forming a human chain, with each man locking his feet under the armpits of the man ahead of them. Together, they would push and pull their way through the pipe until they were free, he said, and then send help for Rishi.
We form a chain, like, I tell him, I say, listen, I'll put my foot underneath Kaz's shoulder. Kaz, see if you could lock onto Yusuf. Yusuf, see if you could push Kaz, see if you could push everybody.
But before they could move, the men were faced with a life or death decision. Which way should they crawl? If they ended up at berth 6 where they entered, there would be a chance to escape. But if they ended up at berth 5, which was sealed shut, it would mean certain death. Everything had happened so fast, Chris didn't even know which way he had been pulled into the pipe, head first or feet first. The others reasoned with him. Chris was the furthest away from the riser, so probably the last one to be dragged in. That would make him the front of the chain, they concluded. So, lead the way. Majority rules, Chris conceded. No matter what happened next, they were doing it together. The men said a brief prayer and began to move, dragging themselves, inch by agonizing inch, into the unknown. The first sign of trouble above the water was a faint noise, followed by a slight shudder of the barge and a few bubbles breaking the surface. The camera feed from inside the habitat, which was rarely monitored in real time, had gone dark. LMCS diving supervisor Andrew Farah was the first to notice. He suited up and went down to scope out the scene himself. When Andrew reached the chamber, it was empty, completely empty. There were no divers, no tools, even the light was gone. The only explanation Farah told those waiting on the boat when he returned was that everything had been sucked into the pipeline. An emergency call went out. Nearby, Nicholas Kerbin, one of Faizi's sons, heard the transmission. He immediately called his brother. Michael, our father is stuck in the pipeline at berth 6, he said. Everybody on the barge is shaking. No one knows what to do. Within minutes, Michael and Nicholas recruited their uncle, Ronald Ramatar, and a friend, Corey Crawford. All four were trained divers. They were on site within 40 minutes, already in full gear. They found LMCS supervisors and PERIA officials gathered on the barge, discussing options for a rescue operation. Wasting time. How long are they missing? One of the Kerbin brothers asked. About 2 hours. Okay, we're going in. We don't think that's a good idea, someone from PERIA protested. Ronald and Corey exchanged a look, then dove in without hesitation. Meanwhile, 60 feet below, after nearly an hour of steady, excruciating progress, the human chain's movement through the pipeline came to an abrupt stop. They'd reached the end of the air pocket. Beyond that point, the pipe was completely flooded. If they wanted to survive, they would need to crawl through an unknown stretch of water. A more positive development, however, was that both Fizey Kerbin and Christopher Boodrum had found oxygen tanks they could share with the others, buying themselves more time, but not much. Christopher volunteered to push forward and scout what was ahead. He took one of the tanks and disappeared into the abyss, and he was gone for what seemed like forever, but eventually emerged with bad news. They would never make it as a group, Chris told them. There was too much water and not enough oxygen to share. Again, it was decision time.
And I found one tank fight, he found one also. He was able to move well enough to get back, to get through this water, all right? And we made the decision, and everybody agreed that we would go first and come back for help. I promise each and every one of them that I'll be back for them. If I can't come back, I'll send help.
It was decided that Chris and Fizey would go ahead and come back with help. Small Kaz and Yusuf panicked. No, brother, you can't go. We all going to die. I have to go, brother boy, Chris told them. If I stay here, none of we seeing our children. I have to get help. Small Kaz grabbed onto Chris's legs, refusing to let go. Chris had to kick free. The last thing he heard was their voices begging as he slipped back beneath the water. Chris started swimming. It felt like 20 minutes before he reached another air pocket. He broke the surface, gasping. Then moments later, Fizey surfaced behind him. There's more water ahead, Chris said. Let's wait, Fizey replied. But time was running out. I can't wait, brother. I have to get help. Chris put his mouthpiece back in and pushed forward again. The next stretch felt endless. His breathing grew harder and shorter. The tank was running low. Chris searched frantically for another pocket of air, but it never appeared. And just as he began to accept that this is where it was all going to end, his hand brushed against something cold. Another oxygen tank. Chris jammed the oil-covered mouthpiece between his teeth and kept going. Minutes later, he reached a dead end. It was the elbow of the pipeline. From there, Chris turned upward, climbing the vertical riser until he broke through. There it was, the habitat. He had gone the right way. But whatever joy Chris may have felt was short-lived when he realized there was no one inside the chamber waiting to pull him out.
None of my, I would call them family was inside there waiting for me. No rescue diver, no, nobody was inside that chamber. When I see that, I wasn't sure if I was living still.
Christopher couldn't lift himself out of the riser. The water level was too low. The platform was out of reach. His only hope was the chain hanging above. Chris jumped for it 5 or 6 times before he managed to grab it. But he had nothing left. He was too exhausted, injured, and drenched in oil to climb. Chris found another chain to help suspend himself out of the water, and that's where he broke. He started crying and screaming, slamming the chain against the pipe in defeat. It felt like days had passed him by before he heard that knock. It was coming from outside the pipe. Next, a faint light appeared overhead in the habitat. Chris's eyes struggled to adjust. I swear to God it was the angel of death coming for me, Chris recalled. I told myself that this was the light that people talk about. Suddenly, a silhouette appeared. Chris recoiled in fright. "Who is you?" "It's me, Raleigh. Your neighbor. Vizy's brother-in-law. Ronald Ramatar. Raleigh, save me. Save me, boy." Ronald tried to pull him out, but couldn't do it alone. Chris was too slick with oil. Just then, right on cue, the other diver, Corey Crawford, entered the habitat. They found a piece of rope and tied two loops for Chris's feet, which they used to drag him out. Christopher Boodrum collapsed on the platform. It was around 6 p.m. He'd been in the pipeline for over 3 hours. "They're all in there," he told the divers. "Vizy wasn't too far behind me. Go back for him now. The others are in the air pocket waiting." They gave Chris an oxygen tank and helped him swim to the surface where the LMCS barge was anchored. Nicholas and Michael Kerbin were there to greet him.
"I say, Michael, go and save your father." And Michael said, "All right." And he started to pace back on foot on the habitat, on top of the habitat. And I was like, "What were you doing, buddy? Go and save I used some profanities. Your father."
Christopher Boodrum had to be prevented from performing the rescue himself. They told him he was in shock and rushed him back to shore and then to the hospital. Below, Ronald Ramatar stayed in the habitat, waiting and listening for other signs of life. He picked up the chain block Chris had used and struck the pipe 4 times. Ronald said he felt the vibration of 4 taps in return, so he did it again and again and again. The same response every time. Chris was right. Vizy Kerbin, Kazim Ali Jr., Yusuf Henry, and Rishi Nagasaw were still alive.
The following is a paid advertisement for the Swindled Valued Listener Rewards Program.
Are you tired of hearing advertisements in Swindled like this one? Do you wish there was more Swindled content to distract you from your miserable existence? Don't settle for those other inferior podcasts with the annoying hosts who laugh at their own jokes. Become a Swindled Valued Listener today to receive easy access to new episodes and exclusive access to bonus episodes that are not available anywhere else. Completely advertisement free. It's fun for the whole family, but don't take our word for it.
I used to spend so much time and energy on so-called improvements like exercise, eating healthy, and therapy. But for just $5 a month, my Swindled Valued Listener membership puts into perspective that it doesn't really matter. We're all doomed. Thanks, Swindled. I guess.
Millions of Swindled fans have discovered the secret of becoming a valued listener. Try it in your own home today. Also, act now to receive the Valued News for Valued Listeners update show at no extra cost. That's a $5,000 value for one easy monthly payment of $4.99.
Go to valuedlistener.com to sign up using Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Patreon. No long-term commitments, satisfaction guaranteed, foreign currency accepted, cancel any time. Please, just give us your money.
Minister of Energy and Energy Industry Stuart Young has confirmed that he's received a briefing on an incident involving 4 employees of a marine engineering company who have been reported missing following a mishap during an underwater project at a berth operated by Paria Trading Company Limited in Point of Pier. On Friday afternoon, 5 divers working for LMCS Limited, a diving company, contracted to perform underwater maintenance work for Paria Fuel Trading Company Limited, were conducting an underwater maintenance exercise when an incident took place resulting in the divers going missing. One of the divers has since been rescued. Reports are that he was taken to hospital where he remains in stable condition.
Paria Fuel Trading Company issued its first public statement just after 9 p.m. on February 25, 2022, nearly 7 hours after the incident. The company confirmed that 5 men had been trapped inside a pipeline during an underwater maintenance operation at Berth 6. At the time, only one of those men had been recovered. Still, Paria assured the public, quote, "Further rescue efforts are currently underway with the support of the Trinidad and Tobago Coast Guard." That last part wasn't entirely true. 10 members of the Coast Guard had arrived roughly 20 minutes earlier, but quickly determined they were neither equipped nor willing to attempt a rescue. The space was too confined, and they were not trained for such a feat. Plus, the cause of the incident was still unknown, and the pipeline probably contained hazardous material. As Lieutenant Commander Edric Hargraves later explained, the risks were too great. He advised Peria's on-site technical lead, Catherine Balkison, that specialized commercial diving equipment would be required. Fortunately, there were people present who were prepared to act. The LMCS divers and volunteers, including Michael and Nicholas Kerbin, had the training and the gear. In fact, Michael had already made an attempt nearly an hour earlier. He descended into the riser and reached the elbow on the seafloor, but his tether prevented him from going any farther. He never saw the divers, he said. Still, there was hope. Around 8 p.m., some LMCS personnel reported hearing knocking from inside the pipe. With additional equipment arriving and more experienced divers on site, the group prepared for another attempt. Then, Peria intervened. Officials told them they did not have permission to enter the pipeline. When the volunteers moved to proceed anyway, armed Coast Guard personnel stepped in. Peria insisted no one would enter the water until a camera was inserted into the pipeline to assess conditions. All the while, time kept slipping away. By 10 p.m., the camera still had not arrived. By then, word of the accident had spread through the community. Families of the trapped men began gathering at the Peria facility, desperate for answers, but they weren't allowed inside. Instead, they were forced to wait in a nearby bus lot, standing in the rain with no food, no water, and no access to restrooms. No one from Peria came out to accommodate them. All they could do was wait and hope the company was doing more for the men inside the pipe than it was for the families outside. Back at Berth 6, it was well past midnight now, and the rescue effort was no closer to success. The remotely operated camera they had waited hours for couldn't make it past the elbow of the riser. A second ROV was too large to fit inside the 30-inch pipe. Another camera arrived around 3 a.m., but it fared no better. About 200 feet in, it encountered a scuba tank wedged against the wall, which stopped it in its tracks. So, Peria's incident management team decided to try inserting the camera from the other side at berth 5. That attempt also failed miserably. The oil inside the pipeline was too thick. Visibility was zero. All the while, the volunteer divers, ready and willing to risk their lives, stood by helplessly. At this point, their friends and family had been stuck in the pipe for more than 15 hours. A hushed acceptance fell over the once bustling scene. So still, you could almost hear a pin drop. Or if you listened closely enough, the faint, rhythmic tapping from deep inside the pipeline, which continued into the morning. At 2 p.m. on Saturday, February 26, 2022, nearly 24 hours after the incident, Trinidad's Minister of Energy, Stuart Young, and representatives from Peria Fuel Trading Company met with the families for the first time. They assured them they were doing, quote, everything possible to rescue their loved ones, knowing full well that zero Peria-approved manned attempts had even taken place, even as Kazim Ali Sr. and LMCS continued to plead for permission to try again. Another entire day passed without any updates. Then, on Sunday, February 27, 2022, Peria announced a surprise press conference at 7 p.m. Seated at the table were General Manager Mushtaq Mohammed, Operations Manager and Incident Commander Colin Piper, and Chairman Newman George.
I would now like to invite our Chairman, Mr. Newman George, to provide a current update.
Good evening to the media and to the listening and viewing public. A joint meeting with LMCS Limited, Peria Fuel Trading Company Limited, Trinidad and Tobago Coast Guard, as well as independent subject matter experts, today agreed on a way forward with respect to the location and recovery of the four divers who have been trapped in the 30-inch pipeline. Based on advice from all the experts, The operation has now moved from rescue to recovery.
From rescue to recovery. Even though there was no definitive proof the men were dead, General Manager Mushtaq Mohammed admitted, but the company said its decision was based on two factors, the extremely low likelihood of survival and the risk of endangering additional lives in any further rescue attempt. Our focus now, he said, is to treat these bodies with respect during the process of recovery and return to their loved ones. Even that respectful recovery process had already been decided. Peria planned to fill the pipeline with water and flush them out.
We call it a liquid displacement process, where we are going to displace that liquid at a rate to be able to move those bodies very slowly to the point where they could be recovered. Very slowly, very carefully, very respectfully, to the point where they could be recovered.
The announcement stunned everyone, especially the families who remained camped outside Peria's facility, patiently waiting for news. Why did they have to learn about these decisions from the TV reports like everyone else? How could Peria be so heartless?
Because I am speaking not only for myself, but all the family who is going through this ordeal right now. I don't wish anyone to be going through what I am going through right now. It is hurting.
That's Vanessa Kusi, Rishi Nagasaw's wife. She couldn't understand why Peria was giving up so easily, and the plan to simply pump their bodies out of the pipeline only deepened the trauma.
The divers are willing to go down and still take them out one by one. Please do not flush them out. They will come out in pieces. We are pleading to them. We are begging them. They're not listening.
The families were not the only ones blindsided by Peria's decisions. The volunteer divers, who had spent more than 2 days at Berth 6 waiting for permission to act, learned the news the same way everyone else did, on their phones. Michael Kerbin, in particular, was incensed. He organized his own press conference in the bus lot where the families had been waiting, determined to set the record straight. There was time to save the men, he told the cameras. He and his brother were ready to enter the pipeline to rescue their father. Kazim Ali Sr. and the LMCS divers were prepared to go in after his son and the others, but Peria Fuel Trading Company had stood in their way.
We was ready. Everybody was ready. Peria break everybody who up till today. All these guys are tired. Everybody is stressed out. And now you want to recover them by pushing them with pressure. You know what I'm going to do to them?
Michael said that at the time, he demanded to know who made the call to prevent people like him from entering the water. Who was it that decided to abandon his father and the other men? No one at Peria would give him a straight answer, but Michael believed he already knew. It was Colin Piper, he announced, Peria's operations manager and incident commander. Colin Piper, Michael accused, had blood on his hands.
Manager, so-called manager, said, do not dive into the pipeline again. And I asked, who is the manager? Say that. Nobody didn't want to say the name. But I would say the name because this man, Colin Piper, close,
yeah,
right? They still had time to save them, guys. Still had time. All this bullshit, all this talk you're talking in the press conference, try not to cover up your tracks, partner. Because you're not covering up your tracks. Right? You're not covering up your tracks. You are a murderer in my eyes.
Yes!
Murderer in my eyes.
Early Monday morning, February 28, 2022, a crew from Peria Fuel Trading Company arrived at the site to prepare for the liquid displacement operation. Everyone else was ordered to leave, and when some of the volunteer divers and the LMCS personnel refused, their phones were confiscated. The area was then sealed off with tarps to block out any prying eyes. After several delays, pumping began from Berth 5 just before 6 p.m. Within minutes, objects started to emerge from the other end. Scuba tanks, gloves, masks, fins. Then, a body. Based on the watch still on his wrist, it was Faisal Kerbin, but his face was unrecognizable, covered in oil and disfigured by pressure. Faisal's remains were placed in a nondescript box and snuck out through a back entrance, away from the families who had gathered nearby. Two more bodies soon followed. One was Kazim Ali Jr., later identified by the jersey he was wearing beneath his wetsuit. The other was Yusuf Henry, identified by his tattoos. Yusuf's father said they were warned before the identification that what they were about to see was disturbing. "My son, I guess, is going to be a closed casket," he said afterward. Within hours, videos of the three recovered divers in the morgue began circulating online. Meanwhile, Rishi Nagasaw's body remained inside the pipeline, still lodged at the bottom of the sea.
The search continues for diver Rishi Nagasaw. Paria said consultation meetings were held throughout Tuesday night with other technical experts to review alternative methods. They have attempted to use remotely operated cameras to try and locate the body, but have not been successful. The company also urged the public and interest groups to be thoughtful of presenting or sharing misinformation to the various media platforms.
It took another 3 days to retrieve Rishi. His body had been effectively entombed behind a piece of equipment. The recovery operation ultimately used a device known as a foam pig to force him loose. Vanessa Kusi, Rishi's wife, said she was holding their 2-year-old son when the call finally came, just after midnight. It had been another sleepless night, another round of questions from the child, asking when his father would come home. "Right now, my family is broken, and there are no words to explain how we are feeling at this time," she told the Trinidad Guardian. "I don't think enough is being done, and this whole situation just shows the level of corruption in Trinidad and Tobago." Vanessa's comments captured only a fraction of the outrage spreading across the island. The delayed response, the lack of preparedness, the negligence. Someone needed to answer for these things. Family members and supporters gathered outside Paria Fuel Trading Company offices, demanding accountability. Some stood outside the home of Colin Piper, holding picket signs. In the immediate aftermath, the only tangible assistance offered to some of these grieving families was a grocery store gift card. At the same time, Christopher Boudram was recovering in the hospital. After nearly a week in intensive care, he was finally given back his phone. Until then, he hadn't known the full extent of what had happened, that the men he had been trapped with, the men he called brothers, hadn't made it out alive. When he learned the details, Chris was beside himself with anger and spoke out to the media. "Coming out that pipeline and seeing how they left us to die is worse than being in the pipeline," he said. "Paria actually condemned my comrades to death. They have the power to do this? Why? Who gave them the power to stop rescue efforts? That decision," he said, "is first-degree murder." LMCS issued a statement of its own, pointing its finger squarely at Paria and the Coast Guard. "We not only had the manpower and personnel to carry out their rescue," the company said, "but we provided Paria with the methodology to execute it. We were not given a chance to save the lives of our employees, and those who made those decisions must be held accountable." Paria pushed back, calling LMCS's statement unfortunate, and saying it felt compelled to correct what it described as inaccurate and unjust accusations. According to the company, all consulted experts, including LMCS, agreed that a manned rescue would have been far too dangerous. "Any further debate," Paria said, "would be premature and risk distracting from the tragedy and its impact on the families." There would be a time and place for that. Trinidad and Tobago's Prime Minister, Keith Rowley, had already announced that an independent investigation would happen. "I want to give the assurance to the families that nothing will stand in the way of determining how this tragedy occurred." Until then, the work continued. Paria flushed the remaining artifacts and human tissue into the ocean and resumed maintenance operations less than 24 hours after Rishi Nagasaw's body was pushed out of the pipe.
As you are aware, after the tragic accident, there were a number of operations that finally resulted in the retrieving of the final body, that of Mr. Rishi Nagasar, last night, just after 12:30 a.m. this morning. And as I had promised, on Monday, one of the things that the government had decided was at the end of this, there would be an independent investigation carried out. Well, I'm happy to say that we have taken a decision this afternoon on the recommendation of the Ministry of Energy and Energy Industries for a 5-panel committee to be composed, and that committee would do a report, do an investigation, and report back to me as a regulator within a 45-day period.
On Thursday, March 3rd, 2022, Trinidad and Tobago's Minister of Energy, Stuart Young, announced the formation of a 5-member panel to independently investigate the Peria diving tragedy. The committee included an attorney, a subsea specialist, an engineer, and representatives from BP and Shell. The panel was tasked with examining the facts and circumstances that led to the incident, as well as the decisions made in its aftermath, including the roles of Peria and LMCS. Young said the findings would be ready within 45 days. But the announcement was met with immediate backlash. Critics across the island, including opposition leader and former Prime Minister Kamala Prasad Besesar, described the appointments as nothing short of scandalous. Some nominees had clear and obvious conflicts of interest, including one individual who had previously been a client of Young's when he practiced law. And with BP and Shell at the table, many questioned whether the industry could be trusted to scrutinize itself. Doubtful. Even if they did, there was skepticism about what would happen afterward. Trinidad's government had an extensive history of commissioning investigations only to withhold their results. In the previous 5 years alone, multiple reports had been completed and never meaningfully acted upon. This wasn't an investigation, critics argued. It was a cover-up committee, and the families of the victims and the citizens of Trinidad and Tobago deserved far more. Facing mounting public pressure, Stuart Young and Prime Minister Rally were forced to backtrack.
What happened thereafter, in diplomatic language, is rather unfortunate, but telling. There became a barrage of what can only be described as disturbing, disappointing for some of us who still have hope that there will be some sense of decency by the opposition, and disgusting behavior straight from the leader of the opposition and a number of agents of the opposition. I took the time to outline some of this so that you, the population, would understand what led to the Prime Minister, the Honorable Prime Minister's decision that he announced to us a couple nights ago, when he took a decision because of the attempts to make a circus out of a most serious investigation. And he declared that he would ask the Cabinet to consider and to approve a commission of inquiry into this tragic accident.
A commission of inquiry would assume a similar fact-finding mandate as the original investigation, but with far sharper teeth. Unlike the earlier panel, the COE operates in public and carries the legal authority to compel testimony and demand documents. It is typically chaired by an independent judge or senior legal figure. In this case, that role ultimately fell to Jerome Lynch, a widely respected King's Counsel barrister with extensive experience in white-collar crime. Peria Fuel welcomed the commission, expressing confidence that a full airing of the facts would clear the company of any allegations of wrongdoing. But for Christopher Boudram and many of the victims' families, the inquiry felt like a waste of time and resources. It would better serve those most affected, those who still hadn't seen a dime. So much money for this pappy show, when I have no money to even buy books for my children for school. When I still wake up at 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, hearing the voices of the men calling me to help them, Boudram told Trinidad Guardian. That was another reason he dreaded the proceedings. Chris knew he would have to testify and relive the worst day of his life in detail. The trauma had already reshaped his existence profoundly. Chris couldn't work. He couldn't sleep. He'd been diagnosed with amnesia and PTSD. How can I teach my daughter to swim when I'm afraid to go in the water? Chris wondered aloud. I feel like it would have been better to die with them than to live like this.
We will, I'm afraid, hear some footage of the men who were alive in the pipe. It is harrowing to listen to. Anyone who feels that that might be too much should leave when it's being played. I have to tell you, there's no one who has listened to it who has not been moved.
The Commission of Inquiry's evidentiary hearings began on November 21st, 2022, at the International Waterfront Center in Port of Spain, with a viewing of the footage captured by the GoPro small Kaz was wearing when the five divers were sucked into the pipeline, much of which you have already heard. By this stage of the inquiry, the investigative stage had already been completed. The cause of the tragedy was determined to be a Delta P, or differential pressure event. Unbeknownst to the LMCS divers, the pipeline had been cleared of oil in the weeks leading up to the job, creating a dangerous pressure imbalance preserved by the inflatable plug in the riser at berth 6. When the inflatable plug was removed, that imbalance suddenly equalized, triggering a powerful influx of water into the pipeline and generating a violent suction effect that pulled the divers inside. With proper protocols, all of this could have easily been mitigated. The root cause of the tragedy was determined to be a failure of both Peria Fuel Trading Company and LMCS to recognize this hazard. This conclusion was emphasized by the botched rescue operation that followed. If the four divers remaining in the pipe hadn't died before the attempt to insert the camera at berth 5, unsealing that second riser would have certainly sped up the process. The pressure in the pipe would have decreased dramatically, and the men would have drowned due to the displacement of liquid inside the pipe. Or even worse, they would have been subjected to instant and extreme decompression. What does that mean? Well, grab yourself a soda can and shake it up real good until it feels like it's about to explode. Then pull the tap quickly and watch it erupt because of the sudden pressure change. It's like that, but instead of carbon dioxide, it's nitrogen. And instead of soda, it's blood. And instead of pouring out of an aluminum can, the reaction would be contained within your organs and your body. It would feel like being internally ripped to shreds by little gas bubbles while the surrounding sea is being forced into your lungs. By all accounts, there are very few worse ways to go. And according to the timeline established by the autopsies, it's likely some of the trapped divers were not spared from that experience.
The conclusion of the postmortem report was that at the maximum, 39 hours and 15 minutes, a man was alive down there while Paria was preventing people from going into the pipeline and rescuing them. At the least, he was alive for 15 hours.
Of course, the men being alive in the pipe was not news to Christopher Boodrum, who was the first witness to testify at the inquiry. The lone survivor wept as he recounted the horror from that day and the overwhelming guilt he still felt for failing to fulfill his promise of coming back for the others.
Every single time you open a rescue was going on. Nobody was making an attempt to rescue you. You know what I mean?
Again, Boodrum placed the blame solely on Peria for not saving his brothers. The LMCS supervisors on site that day repeated the same accusation in their testimonies. Even Edric Hargraves of the Coast Guard rejected the notion that his unit stood in the way. He acknowledged they lacked the training and equipment to carry out the rescue themselves, but never discouraged anyone else from trying. Quote, "I don't have the requisite qualifications to stop such a rescue." When representatives from Peria finally took the stand, they had no issue defending its actions, or lack thereof.
How would you rate the management of this incident on that day? How would you rate the management of the incident on the 25th that caused four men to perish? How would you rate yourselves? You heard the chairman, yeah. We do not have all evening, please. Take your sip of water.
Yeah. I would rate it as excellent.
Thank you very much. Four men died in an incident that you were to manage, and you consider that excellent. Thank you very much.
That was Michael Way, Peria's technical manager. He argued that sending additional divers into the pipeline would have been reckless. The conditions inside were unknown, and at that point, the company didn't even understand what had triggered the event. Despite the loss of life, Way maintained that Peria had responded appropriately. It was an ethical consideration, agreed General Manager Mushtaq Mohammed. A balancing act, added technical lead Catherine Balkison. Almost like the classic trolley dilemma, which lives would you choose to save? Taking no action, in Catherine's opinion, was a form of action.
Peria also took action by telling NMCS not to dive. Peria also took action to say, listen, hold up. Are you sure you want to dive in there? Because these are the risks too, huh? Someone's lives could be lost, huh? It's a balancing act, right?
It might be a different balancing act if it was your father that was in the pipe or your son. I think we'll take a break then.
No, that's not fair.
No. Is there an objection to that?
Because...
One person who would object was Colin Piper, Peria's operations manager, the man who ultimately decided to stop any rescue attempt from taking place. He testified over 2 days, beginning December 14th, 2022. Piper acknowledged that he made that call without consulting anyone else, relying instead on what he described as his vast experience in the industry. There were simply too many unknowns, he said. But what he did know was that the men were trapped in a confined space, and the situation was inherently dangerous, and those volunteering to go in had never attempted anything like it and were acting under intense emotional strain. Those facts alone, Piper said, solidified his decision. Sending additional divers into the pipe would not have been prudent.
So in an emergency response, the worst thing you can do in an emergency response is to act instinctively and to act emotionally. That is the absolute way you should not respond in an emergency. And definitely in this case, you don't respond like that in an emergency. And therefore, I had no choice but to say, stop, we need to assess, we need to understand what is going on. So I took that decision. As difficult as that decision was, don't believe for 1 minute that was a simple decision. And that was an extremely difficult decision. But at that point, it was the decision that had to be taken.
Colin Piper still believed it was the right call, although it tormented him. I had 4 men in that pipe, he said. I had husbands in that pipe. I had fathers in that pipe. I had sons in that pipe. Whose father should I have allowed and sanctioned to go down in that pipe? Whose son should I have allowed to go down in that pipe? Whose husband should I have sanctioned to go down in that pipe and perish? He asked. Why would he be so reckless with other people's lives?
If you believe in this room that that was a simple thing because we had 4 men in that pipe, if you believe that I just sat there and decided I'm just not sending a man in a pipe, right? You simply do not understand what we went through that night.
At the close of the commission, Gilbert Peterson, counsel for Peria, argued that the company bore no legal duty to save the 4 men and that its actions were entirely reasonable. Every expert they consulted had agreed, he said. Then he posed a hypothetical. In a different world, the Peria had authorized the rescue, and those men had died. We would still be here, Peterson argued, asking a different question. Why did Peria allow such a dangerous rescue to take place in the face of so many unknowns? There was no winning in the situation, he alluded, without considering the scenario of a successful rescue.
It is as well to remember how this commission of inquiry came about. It was unequivocally as a result of public pressure. The desire for you, the public, to have a real attempt at truth, to find out what happened, why it happened, why was so little done to rescue them, and how we can stop this ever happening again. Let's be clear, this was no act of God or mere unlucky accident.
After sifting through tens of thousands of documents, video and audio recordings, transcripts, and correspondence, on top of 6 months of public hearings and multiple delays, the Commission of Inquiry convened for the last time on November 29, 2023. Chairman Jerome Lynch announced the Commission's 380-page report would be delivered to President Christine Kangaloo the following day, 21 months after the incident. Along with it, he would include a recommendation that the report be made public. After all, it was the public who had demanded the inquiry, and the public who had paid for it. Lynch said he was satisfied that the commission had done what it was created to do, establish the facts, scrutinize the decisions, and determine responsibility. However, one aspect of the process had left a bitter taste in his mouth.
One feature of this inquiry that has become clear beyond peradventure to anyone who has been watching the inquiry unfold is that throughout the process, at no stage has anyone conceded a single error, a single mishap, or a single recognition of a failure, even with the benefit of hindsight. We understand that there is a desire not to accept liability, lest that should incur responsibility of financial responsibility in some civil suit at some later stage. But these men, as I said already, did not die by accident. What they're left with, and their families are left with, is posturing of the potential parties, perhaps challenging the very findings of this inquiry before they start fighting with each other, each insisting that they got nothing wrong.
Additionally, Lynch criticized the way the families were treated in the immediate aftermath of the tragedy. He described Perry's failure to keep them informed and the lack of provisions such as basic shelter, toilets, food, and water as insensitive and uncivilized.
Nothing in Parrier's documentation or LMCS's HSE manual or anything else deals with communication by the employer or contractor with the victims' families in an emergency situation. They should.
Implementing formal protocols for engaging with the families of the victims was one of 52 recommendations in the commission's final report. It also called for Trinidad and Tobago to update its diving regulations that hadn't been revised since 1997. After Petrogen's collapse, union influence had waned and long-standing safety frameworks had eroded. Fewer standardized rules and aggressive cost-cutting took their place, intensifying competition in an already dangerous industry. The result was predictable: lower paid, less qualified workers, and more accidents, most of which were quietly buried. In fact, Christopher Boodrum and Rishi Nagasaw had narrowly escaped death just weeks before the pipeline incident when an explosion erupted near Berth 2. One of their colleagues lost a leg, yet no statements were taken. No broader alarm was raised. Business as usual. Something had to change. Seeking to compel that change, the commission recommended that Trinidad and Tobago's Director of Public Prosecutions consider charging Peria with corporate manslaughter. But the odds of that happening were slim, and even if such a case did move forward and succeed, the most likely outcome would be a financial penalty. And Peria is state-owned, so guess who would ultimately be footing the bill? And as Chairman Lynch had mentioned, the taxpayers had already funded the inquiry itself, which ended up costing roughly $21 million, more than half of which was spent on legal fees. Vulgar and obscene was how Vanessa Cousy described it. People were getting rich off of their suffering, while the families, many of whom had lost their primary breadwinners, were left organizing charity barbecues and relying on neighbors to get by. Workers' compensation was stalled pending insurance. Insurance was stalled pending liability. Civil suits had been effectively frozen until the Commission of Inquiry concluded, and the families needed help yesterday, especially Christopher Boodrum, whose medical bills were rapidly mounting. But that help never came. Until.
But recognizing the difficulty and the trauma and the tragic circumstances of these divers, and we're going to make ex gratia payments of $1 million to each of the families of the deceased divers and to Mr. Boodrum.
On April 4th, 2025, former Energy Minister Stuart Young, who had assumed the role of Prime Minister after Keith Rowley's resignation, announced that the government of Trinidad and Tobago would provide payments of $1 million to the families of each diver who died in the pipeline, as well as Christopher Boodrum. Young described the payments as ex gratia, meaning they carried no admission of liability and would not prevent the families from pursuing further damages in court. The timing raised immediate suspicion. A general election was just weeks away, and Young was seeking to keep his party in power. Opposition leader Kamla Prasad Besesser called the move the lowest election stunt Stuart Young has ever pulled. It reeks of desperation, she said. Voters ultimately agreed, handing a majority of seats to Prasad Besesser's party and reinstating her as prime minister. But for those most affected by the Paria tragedy, the promised compensation still hadn't materialized. That would finally change in January 2026. Just weeks before the four-year anniversary of the incident, Prime Minister Prasad Besesser followed through on the payments, which she described as long overdue. For Christopher Boodrum, the relief was immediate. He described receiving the funds as a breath of fresh air, something that he would know more about than anybody. Christopher Boodrum and the other families continue to pursue legal action against Paria, and they're still searching for some semblance of justice. It's been 4 years, Boodrum told The Guardian, and nobody lost their job. Nobody was jailed. Trinidad's Occupational Safety and Health Authority and agency did lay charges against Paria and several executives for failing to ensure the safety of their employees and contractors, but those charges amounted to regulatory violations of workplace safety, basically a slap on the wrist. Even then, every defendant has pleaded not guilty, still convinced that no mistakes were made. Swindled is written, researched, produced, and hosted by me, a concerned citizen, with original music by Trevor Howard, aka The Former, aka Delta T. For more information about Swindled, you can visit swindledpodcast.com and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok at Swindled Podcast. Or you can send us a postcard at P.O. Box 2045, Austin, Texas 78768. But please, no packages. We do not trust you. Swindled is a completely independent production, which means no network, no investors, no bosses, no shadowy money men, no balancing acts. And we plan to keep it that way, but we need your support. Become a valued listener on Patreon, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify at valuedlistener.com. For as little as $5 a month, you will receive early access to new episodes and exclusive access to bonus episodes that you can't find anywhere else. And everything is 100% commercial free. Become a valued listener at valuedlistener.com. Or if you want to support the show and need something to wear under your wetsuit, consider buying something you don't need at swindledpodcast.com/shop. There are t-shirts, patches, hats, hoodies, posters, coffee mugs, and more. SwindledPodcast.com/shop. And remember to use coupon code CAPITALISM to receive 10% off your order. If you don't want anything in return for your support, you can always simply donate using the form on the homepage. That's it. Thanks for listening.
Hello. My name is Cindy C. from Seattle, Washington.
Hello, my name is Lila, and I'm from Point Reyes Station, California.
Hi, my name is Zach, and I'm calling from Boone, North Carolina.
I'm a concerned citizen and a valued listener.
For some reason, I trust every... Fuck that up. Oh, can you not redo it? Shit.
Yo, it's Jey Uso from WWE,
and I'm Jimmy Uso.
Chumba Casino and WWE are hyped for the biggest event of the summer, SummerSlam.
I know, I can't wait.
There's nothing better to do while we're waiting
than playing Chumba Casino.
Sign up today and you could win a VIP experience
with Chumba Casino and WWE for SummerSlam.
So what are you waiting for?
Play Chumba Casino and enter for your chance to win. Let's Chumba.
Yeah. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.